I was in the chamber with my daughter, the Senate chamber, and this was before I decided to run. And she looked in the Senate chamber and she asked me, "Mom, do they let girls serve in the Senate?" And it just made my heart sink.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. One of Wyoming's nicknames is the Equality State. Wyoming elected the first woman governor in the United States and the first woman justice of the peace. Wyoming also had the first women voters and the first all-woman jury. But photographer Lindsay Linton thinks we've fallen behind. So she began a photography and podcast series called Women in Wyoming to showcase groundbreaking women throughout the state and to inspire young people everywhere to pursue their dreams without losing their roots. All of Linton's portraits and interviews are at womeninwyoming.com, and this is the second of two episodes featuring excerpts of those conversations. Both women we're about to hear from talk about the importance of connection to yourself, to the moment, and to the people around you. Nelchi is an abstract impressionist painter, artist, and author living on a ranch in Wild Wyoming.
I can hear you, I can see you, I can feel you. My name is Nelchi. I was born in New York City in 1934, in October, so I'm a Libra. Fire away. Well, color. We'll start with color. I don't know what my favorite color is. Probably red.
Why is red your favorite color?
Because it's outrageous. It denotes danger and courage and strength and an unwillingness to be put down.
Sounds like you.
Yeah, and I think back, as I said that, I think back to childhood where I was put down all the time simply because I was a girl and there was nothing I could do about it, but I didn't know that. I didn't know that was the reason, so I always thought there was something wrong with me. And I fought back, and this urge not to be put down was then deemed as I was out of control. It was non-acceptable. And my mother used to say, "Stop crying wolf, stop making scenes." I wasn't making scenes. I was simply wanting to be heard. So that, in a nutshell, gives you the sense of what my urge was from the youngest time. And simply by being a woman, by being female, I was not registered within the family as being worth anything.
Can you describe the high society life that you grew up in New York? What was it like?
Well, I never thought that we were high society because my father died when I was so young. And I remember it was much more the theatrical and the book world. I mean, Noel Coward was around and there were actors around. And my sister was involved in the theater, but my sister, older half-sister, Bucky. It was literary. It was a world of glamour more than society. So this whole society thing was something else. But I was trained to be subservient, to be to men, to be charming. And I didn't live with my mother and father very often. I mean, I was mostly lived with nurses and governesses and mademoiselles and the maids and aunts and uncles. And then I was sent away to school when I was 12. And they had this whole other life that was just between the two of them.
And how did that affect you growing up and having your parents essentially be absent?
It always made me feel abandoned. You know, there was something wrong with me that they didn't want me. You know, even when I was a child, I was molested by a friend of the family, which is now I found out is, you know, not unusual. That was another thing that put me down, was because I thought this man loved me. And he would bring me chocolate from the base. He was a naval pilot. He would bring me a locket with his picture in it.
And how old were you and how old was he?
I was 9. He was married, had kids. And then when I finally told somebody, and he had threatened to kill me if I told anybody. And those words lasted almost my full lifetime. I think I finally, by the age of 60, and I walked into a coffee shop and there were guys there. And it was the first time I wasn't terrified. I walked up to and ordered coffee and a bagel. And the saliva did not dry up in my mouth. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a long, long time.
Yeah. What was the most healing part for you to get through that abuse?
Time, therapies, allowing myself to be sad at the age of 45 and crying, and for the little girl who got disappointed that the guy didn't truly love me. He just was using me to satisfy his needs for that moment for him without regard. That was such a disappointment. And everybody has boulders they have to climb over in their life. And I don't know whether mine are less than, more than, or there's any point in comparing them. I don't think so. It took me to midlife and beyond to really understand fully that I was responsible for myself and I had to do it on my own. And once you learn that lesson, once I learned that lesson for me, and I don't know how it works for anybody else, it was freeing. I could work. I could do what I wanted to do, and the failures that were there were fine because I was cognizant of what I was doing and why I was doing it, and I wasn't doing it in reaction to something from childhood. There isn't the knight in shining armor who's coming galloping up and going to carry you away and make life beautiful. So, you know, all the fantasies we're given as kids are detrimental. They're not a help. Yes, there are people who help you along the way. Yes, there are people who set problems and show you ways to solve them. That's the kindest thing they can do.
What do you feel like it takes to be your own hero, your own knight in shining armor?
It takes, first of all, time and a willingness to be open and to recognize your powers and your vulnerabilities and check both of them off to being a plus. It's like saying, all right, I know I'm generous, but on the other hand, there was a good deal of time where I would go across town and buy carrots at 2 cents less per packet or 5 cents less per packet because there was a miserliness about me. There's always a flip side to everything positive or everything negative. I think I learned that from an alcoholic counselor when I was sobering up, who said, you know, line up your pluses on a piece of paper and your minuses, and once you do that, you kind of see, oh my goodness. And it's an oh my goodness in a detrimental way, and it's positive. It's very enlightening to know that if you have a temper, which I do, I also have a generosity of spirit. So,
I love that. That's such a great exercise to go through.
I did spend probably 3 or 4 years working very hard on myself of trying to see what I was doing. That was very enlightening, and it has been a source of power and energy ever since.
I'm thinking about your paintings and how it seems like color is this great metaphor for your life because your paintings are so full of energy, very colorful, very bold. It's not all held inside anymore. It's out there.
You know, painting gave me a voice. I had a show at the University Museum. I think that was probably my most gratifying moment. And once I started painting and really started painting what I felt, whether it was in reaction to the landscape or it was painting about women being enclosed in boundaries and women breaking boundaries. I didn't care what anybody else thought. What I needed to do was break boundaries, and that gave me permission.
Why do you think it's so important for us to give ourselves that permission, especially as women?
That's a hard question, because really we're not given permission to be. There are still all the same. Underneath are the same vibrations of women should stay within the house and not be involved in the world outside, and certainly not be confrontive about anything. I think that's so stultifying, and I think it's not what our natures are. I don't want to be there, and one of the reasons I wrote the book too was so that there are young women out there who have perhaps gone through being abused or being alcoholic or being drug addicts or whatever. I was hoping that the book in some way would give young women a sense of they too could do what I have done, which is climb the ladder out of the hole and go out and hit a home run. My book is North of Crazy, and that is a little bit because I have a cabin on the little North Fork of Crazy Woman Creek, and a little bit just because I don't fit into any particular category.
What has been the biggest surprise coming out of either writing the book or publishing the book for you that you weren't expecting?
The impassioned response that I've got from people, mostly when people come up and say, you know, I had something like that happen to me, and you wrote about it so well, it has given me the chance to be open about it. And I've had a number of people say that to me, women, and that's the sweetest thing that's happened. That's what I hope for, but, you know.
Wondering if you can paint us a picture of who Nelji is now.
I'm a kind woman. I'm a strong woman. I live in Wyoming on a ranch, same ranch I moved to 50 years ago. I look on the Bighorn Mountains with awe and delight on a daily basis. I have such a delight in being part of nature, being part of the field in front of the house, being part of the garden, whether it's trees or bugs or dogs or deer. I'm an abstract expressionist painter. Galleries don't like me because I don't paint deer in a stream or elk in mountains. They're my way of speaking. They were my way of speaking. I speak out much more now. I could put down my anxiety, my delight, my high level of energy, my wonder, my rage, my tenderness, the whole thing I could put in a painting. And the fact that I will still work in that size canvas at my age is insane, you know?
Yeah, and for those people that haven't seen your canvases, can you describe just what it looks like, the size of it?
Well, what I'm talking about is the 10-foot high by 30-foot long canvases. To be painting something of that size at 82 years old is a certain insanity, because it takes a great deal of physical stamina to do that. And I'm used to doing them in a very short period of time because I work so in such a determined way. And I've never been a painter that could work from my elbow to my fingertips. I work with my whole body. It is far more like a dance, and it's far more like a dance with a machine that is my body going full tilt, you know. And dancing back and forth 30 feet, back and forth, that's long, that's hard. And it is just their voices calling.
What's going through your mind when you're working on a painting?
Usually it gets to be working with the paint. The paint demands, the colors demand. You put up an area of the pale blue, and it needs something that is warm next to it because it's a cold color for me. And then it needs something that's in between, and then it needs something that's really hot, and then it needs... So all this kind of palaver goes on in your mind. But then there's something that comes up from your belly, and there's a line that goes up, way up, and then I take a brush and fill it with paint, and I'll slap it on the canvas. And that slap is not a mean slap. What it is can often be is that because the drops shoot, you can see some way up behind you, they can shoot straight up and off the canvas and onto the ceiling. It's a joy. I couldn't paint that each drop. So I'm here to express in the abstract what I feel about whatever the moment is that I'm painting in. I would say I'm a painter of the moment. I think we all are painters of the moment. We are creators of the moment. I think there are others who are historically inventive, but that's not this rose.
Are there any moments you feel like you've left untouched?
Oh, yeah. The hardest one for me is calm. Because the second I lay down the colors of calm, as you've seen them in the studio, part of me wants to energize them with strokes, 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 strokes. And I don't know where that comes from, but it's a real physical need. It's like I am driven.
What would you want to say to your audience about what your paintings are about as an abstract expressionist painter?
I would say nothing. I would just say, be comfortable with it, if you can be. So, there's not any one thing to understand about it. It's not about a deer in the meadow. It's not about my childhood. It's not about anything in particular. If you get the sensation of joy in that painting, that's terrific. I had a sense of joy in this, and I can see the joy in it. I can see the electricity. I can see the delicacy in places. I can see the chaos, confusion, and the patterns. I can see all that, but you might not see that. You might see something totally different, and that's okay too. That's just as valid as the way I painted it.
I'm thinking of your painting, the one that just says yes. I can't remember if that was an early painting or recent.
That was a painting about when I could fold down the commercial side of me of working at the Sheraton Inn, and I still was working at the Sheraton Inn when I did that, and be a painter.
Saying yes to being a painter.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what that's about.
Do you feel like that was a watershed moment for you?
Absolutely. I kept wanting to get out of working at the inn and wanting to find a home for the inn. I had put my heart and my soul in working at the inn. I became strong working at the inn. I don't want to live in a powder puff world. I don't want my biggest interest to be whether I'm going to have soup or a bologna sandwich for lunch.
You got bigger fish to fry.
I just think it's more interesting. There are things to be done. And in every area, no matter where you live, there are things to be done. whether you're making a park in the city or whether you're trying to help education in a small town in Wyoming. Life is a journey. I was never told that. It was, you know, you graduate from one grade one, you go to grade two, and there was never this, you can do with whatever you want. There was never any support as a child, so I've created my own support system. So now I live with my friends down the valley who work with me on different things, and I have a family here. My kids and grandkids are scattered. They mostly live in New York, but they live very close to me and my heart. It is being ready just to accept tickles your toes and to say, plan ahead. It's just, I don't know how to do it. I don't want to do it. And certainly now at my age, I don't have to do it. I paint the moment. I think the moment. I feel the moment. I don't know what's going to happen when I get out of bed in the morning. It's fractional. You have this second and then boom, it's gone. The wind comes up and your hat flies off. You drop your glass of champagne. You know, there's just a moment.
Our last excerpt from the Women in Wyoming series comes from Affie Ellis. She's the first Navajo and Native American woman serving as a Wyoming state senator.
Both of my parents are Navajo, and they grew up on the reservation. And back in the 1950s, there was a big push to get Native kids a trade education. So both of my parents were sent to a school in Utah. And at that school, my dad learned how to weld. My mom learned just general cleaning service trades. And when they graduated, they decided to move to Jackson, where my dad got a job, and that's where they raised our family.
Was there a reason why they picked Jackson in particular?
I think they loved Jackson in the 50s. It was still very much a kind of a rowdy cow town. And, you know, anyone who's visited the Word Hotel and sees the gambling tables can only imagine how fun of a place and wild of a town that used to be.
And you grew up working class in Jackson. So what was that like growing up in a town that is incredibly affluent and one of the wealthier places, if not the wealthiest place in our state?
Both of my parents worked very hard. My dad runs his own welding shop, and then my mom worked at a dry cleaner, and then on the weekends cleaned rooms at a motel. So that was the norm for me growing up, and it didn't take until me leaving Jackson to realize how much we worked and how difficult it is just to make ends meet in that town. By Wyoming standards, we were a very normal middle-class family, but by Jackson standards, we really had to hustle just to make ends meet. But I wouldn't trade that experience for anything, just because it taught me so many lessons about perseverance, work ethic, and really kind of lit the fire under me to take hold of my future and make some pretty bold changes, knowing that I didn't want to work really hard for minimum wage the rest of my life.
Well, and you were the first, you're the youngest of four, correct?
Yes.
And you were the first person in your family to go to college. So tell me about where that drive came from. Was it from your family? Was it more self-realized?
I remember when I got into the University of Wyoming, my family was pretty sad that I was leaving, knowing that I'd be gone for 4 years. So it was very much something that I took upon myself, but a lot of it grew out of my experience cleaning rooms. And I just will remember one day when I was cleaning a bathroom, and you could tell that the woman who was staying at that hotel had beautiful things, beautiful clothes, luggage, jewelry, and I remember seeing her eye cream on the counter. And I picked it up and I thought about actually putting it on my face just because it was expensive and it looked luxurious. And I looked at myself in the mirror and I thought, so is this my life? I'm going to be always envying things that are out of my reach, working again really hard for minimum wage just to make ends meet, or am I going to do something about it? Kind of at that moment, just felt shame and thought I need to do something different, but I didn't know what to do. And so I figured that the first step for me would be to go to college. And it seemed like college-educated people didn't have to clean motel rooms. And for me, that was a huge step up. So I very much bumbled my way along the path of wanting to get to college on a scholarship. And that wasn't easy, but I definitely had a loving family that was supportive. So I at least had that going for me.
How old were you?
Probably about 14.
You knew in that moment that, okay, I have to get to college. So then what? How did you actually find yourself getting a scholarship and making your way to university?
Well, I think no one can ever underestimate the power of their parents. I mean, if I got nothing else from my folks, it's that they know the value of hard work. And so I just channeled all of that energy and focus into my studies. And in high school, I remember an opportunity coming up to be an intern for the Wyoming legislature. And my family had known Clearing Law, cleaned rooms for her. And I reached out to her, and she recommended me to that program and helped me write my essay. I look back at some of those moments when I came to Cheyenne after being selected for it. I just saw a completely different world. I found politics in the Wyoming legislature to be wildly fascinating. How policy's made, it's much of what's right academically as it is what people are feeling and thinking. So there's a very human element to it. Definitely credit, you know, some of those people in Teton County who are willing to help lift up kids. And, you know, certainly as an adult, that's a person that I hope to be, is someone that inspires and encourages kids to get outside their comfort zone, to see more of the world, and to chase their passions. And that was just a theme that I've had throughout my life, is making sure that I'm giving back, because I know that that creates opportunities for others. And I feel like this life is kind of, it's supposed to come full circle. The more you give, the more you get. And so I just want to pour my heart out into giving as much as I can. And it seems like I can't ever give back enough. I seem to always be on the receiving end of so many great opportunities. And I just want that for everybody.
Can you talk about growing up in Wyoming as a Navajo?
Growing up as a Navajo person in Jackson, I never thought about it until it was my first year of kindergarten, when my mom was getting me ready and she looked at me and she said, "You might not want to tell too many kids that you're Navajo, because people aren't always nice to Indians." And several years ago, when my kids started kindergarten, that memory came flooding back to me. And, you know, obviously we live in a different time where I can tell my kids that being Navajo is really awesome and that a lot of people think it's cool and they should embrace that. But growing up with my experience, I do remember there were moments where kids would tease me in elementary school, just didn't have the confidence to shake off some of those remarks and moments. So it was something that I hid for a long, long time or just didn't talk about. But in high school, I remember competing in a junior Miss competition, and my talent was giving a speech about Navajo Long Walk. And I did overhear someone say, "Oh, she just is doing that. She's playing the race card because she wants a scholarship." And it just really cut me. I think back on that moment, and my family still practiced some traditional Navajo things, but I wanted a deeper understanding of what that meant. And so when I started college at the University of Wyoming, they had an American Indian Studies program, which you could get a minor in. And I took all of those classes, from literature to anthropology to some of the cultural things. But of all of them, the legal classes really struck me as being the most interesting. And so when I moved to Washington, D.C. to work for U.S. Senator Craig Thomas, he served on the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. You started understanding how federal Indian law and policy comes to be and how dynamic it is. And it's so tied to just an amazing history and really a story of America that, for me, I was drawn to really understanding what it meant legally to be Navajo. And it was a big force for me to continue on and working for an agency called the National Indian Gaming Commission. That's a federal regulatory agency. But also when I came back west to go to law school, I went to the University of Colorado in Boulder because they have an amazing Indian law program. This is a really exciting time in Indian law. There are a lot of efforts for tribes to not only retain and protect their sovereignty, but to seek ways to operate in ways that'll make their communities more safe and better serving their citizens. I'm just excited to keep up with some of those developments and hopefully have my hand in guiding some policy.
You became the first Native American person ever to be elected into the Senate in Wyoming and the first Native American woman to the legislature. What does that mean to you?
It's a tremendous honor, and I don't think I think of it in terms, when I look at myself in the mirror, I don't see myself that way. I think I'm just a person doing a job, and a very lucky one to have that honor and privilege to do that work. But there are definitely times where people will ask me about that, and it is inspirational when I see other women doing things like this around the country. I think it's just kind of grappling with that notion that you've done something that no one else has ever done, but also not wanting to just leave it at that, but also be really good at what we're doing in that chamber and be good at what I'm doing and making sure I'm contributing a lot. So it's a huge feat for me and a first step, but I just know I've got more work ahead of me.
Before running for office, you're a lawyer and a businesswoman. What was the moment that made you say, "I'm going to do it," where you wanted to run?
Well, I had participated in a Wyoming Women's Legislative Caucus. They have a Leap into Leadership event. And so I participated in that and was encouraging other women to run. And I think for a lot of women, and not just women, but men too, looking at our underrepresentative numbers, I think it definitely affects our gender a little bit more. I was thinking about it. The worst thing you can do is lose. And once you get your head around how bad that would be to lose, it's really not that bad. And it's something you can recover from. You'll learn great lessons. I was in the chamber with my daughter, the Senate chamber, and this was before I decided to run. And I usually try and get my kids in there to participate and sit in the gallery and listen to some of the debate. And she looked in the Senate chamber and she asked me, "Mom, do they let girls serve in the Senate?" And it just made my heart sink. And I said, "Yes, honey, there's one woman sitting right there." And it was Bernadine Kraft, who had just announced her retirement. And so I thought, there's a great chance that if no women run and win, we will have a chamber where there's zero women serving in the Wyoming Senate. I couldn't shake the thought. Just did a lot of soul searching and visited with a friend of mine and sought her counsel. And she said, "Absolutely, you should do this. And we need women, mainly in Cheyenne, to step up, because at the end of the day, you'll go home, you'll kiss your kids. So if you want to be the voice of a young working mom, we need that voice coming from Cheyenne." The more I thought about it, the more I thought that this was something I needed to do. And, you know, for me, the metric is and will always be, how much have I got to give? And I think that sometimes, as I said, these positions become so consuming, they're part of your identity. For me, I want this to be a job that I do, and I'll look at my job performance, if I'm accomplishing things, if I'm bringing ideas to the table, if I have the energy and passion that I think these jobs require, I'll still do it. But once those energies start going away and you're not really adding much to the conversation, I think it's fair and appropriate to say, I've given it my all. It's time for someone else to take over. Having been involved in politics, I think there's a feeling or a thought that, well, there's just no one out there who can do it as good as I can, and I need to run again, and they feel obliged. And I don't believe that at all. I think that there are talented people all across this state. And unless and until there's an open seat, they don't even think about running. So, you know, I certainly hope I never start thinking that way of, no one else can do this job as good as I can, because people can and they will rise up.
What was the most challenging part of your campaign process after deciding you were going to run?
You know, fortunately, I think I had a really good experience in that my opponent was a very gracious individual. We both ran very clean campaigns. The hardest part about it is the work and coming up with a plan and executing a plan. As long as you're not afraid of how grueling that can be, and if you're doing a Wyoming campaign, I would highly recommend to folks to go door to door. That's just a lot of work, and you do meet some people sometimes who are very unpleasant to you. And the best lesson, though, you can learn is how to shake that off and move on to the next house, because you have to. You're going to get done with your walking. Once you start looking at those challenges as opportunities, it's actually kind of fun. But the hard part is honestly getting in your car, driving to that neighborhood when you're tired and you want to just sit down and eat dinner with your family, and getting out there and knocking on that first door. But once you get started, then it's hard to stop. And these moments matter, because when you're taking a vote, and when you're thinking about how decisions affect people, you remember standing on their doorstep. You remember what they were eating, and maybe they weren't eating the most fancy dinner. Maybe you have a lady who was eating a cup of noodles at her front doorstep, and she's living in a trailer house, and you wonder what that lady does to get by. I mean, you very much can see the people that you represented. And so I feel strongly about making that connection with folks. And it's one thing that I do enjoy about the campaign process, is meeting those people out there, even though you do meet some people that can be very unpleasant. If you don't like people, don't get into politics. I will say that. It's not the right
thing
for
you. What other advice do you have for people considering a career in politics?
Well, I think that's the hard part of it too, is, you know, there's the policy piece of it, understanding the issues. And I like that work. But then there's just the people side of it. Again, I don't think I'm the only person that out there that sees both sides of it. But I think that's one of the great things, though, about our legislatures. When all those folks come together, the things we produce are products of these very different skill sets. To be part of it, it's absolutely humbling.
And you have three kids. So how did they respond when you told them you wanted to run for office?
I have a really supportive family. And I tell people all the time how critical it is, especially to have a spouse that understands who you are and values what you value and understands your goals. And so fortunately, I've got that, and my husband, Dennis, and he and I have three beautiful kids. Their ages are 9, 7, and 3. And last year, I did a lot of soul searching on whether or not I wanted to run for the Senate, knowing that it would be a huge time commitment, and it would require us to change up quite a bit of our routine and our daily lives. So after my husband and I had talked about it and I was leaning toward doing it, I told him I was going to ask the kids when I picked them up from school. They got in my car and I started driving home and I said, you know, this is a big race. What do you guys think about me doing this? It'll be a lot of work. People might say some mean things about me, but this race is important to me. And my daughter Marlo, 8 at the time, said, Mom, you would be so good at this. I'll do whatever you need. I'll help you out with whatever. And I was like, thank you, Marlo. And so I look at my son, who is 7 at the time, and I said, Archie, what do you think? And he said, Mom, I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but I just don't think you're ready. And so I look around and I look at him and I say, I'm not ready. He said, well, maybe if you're more like Dad. And at this point, I pull over my car. I'm coming unglued. And I'm not ready, and I need to be more like Dad. What do you mean by that? And he said, well, you know, when Dad gets ready for his big marathon type races, he's on the treadmill every morning. I never see you on the treadmill, so I think you might hurt yourself. And so I just completely melted and started laughing, and it was absolutely fair criticism. So I better explained what kind of a race I meant, and he said, oh yeah, Mom, you'd be great at that. You should do it.
So sweet.
I know, these kids, they're great.
I mean, you've talked about wanting to give back and especially sort of leave a better world for future generations. And I know your kids are probably a huge part of that. So now that you've had your first term under your belt, what are some of the takeaways and your focus for the next upcoming session?
After the session, a lot of people asked if I had fun. For me, fun is riding my bike or laying by a beach. The work is tremendously rewarding, but it is difficult. It's important to understand the process, though, and really embrace that. And I think that that's one area where, you know, the longer I do this, the more I hope to be effective, is embracing that I'm not the sole person that gets to decide what words are on the page. I mean, it's a collaborative process. You have 89 other people that are going to chime in and weigh in. And so the sooner and better you embrace that idea, I think the more successful you'll be. But definitely Wyoming, I think some of its character and what makes it so special is that we have a citizen legislature. So I very much like the fact that we meet for very short periods of time because people go back to their daily lives and they have their careers and their expertise that they bring to our chamber. But the challenge in that is it is a huge time commitment. I think that's a reason why you see certain demographics not always being able to run. I feel very fortunate to be in Cheyenne, to be a woman, and to have a career that allows me the flexibility to serve in the legislature. I think of this role as one of a fiduciary where I should be able to tell any taxpaying citizen how we're spending their dollars and making sure I've got an understanding of that. It's a big system. We regulate several different industries. There's just a lot of work in knowing how decisions you make affect people, but that's definitely a challenge that I'm drawn to.
You seem so much more seasoned than just serving one term. So where does that confidence come from? Or did you ever have any doubts when you made that decision, I'm going to run?
Well, my first job out of college was working for U.S. Senator Craig Thomas in Washington, D.C. And he was a wonderful guy. And again, talking about people that really focus on bringing up young Wyoming talent, he definitely did that for not just me, but countless of other people throughout the state. And being around individuals like that, I think you could see some of the best and worst parts of politics. There have been lots of studies done on why certain members of Congress do very crazy things or have these behavioral outbursts, that craving of needing to feel something, to do something daring. And so I think that my career in politics, I just always want to remain even-headed and know that this is a job, not an identity. And so when I ran for the legislature, I knew that it wouldn't just be a journey of learning about policy and decision-making, but it would be one of self-growth and really becoming the person that you really want to be, which is someone who understands the severity of the decisions we make, respects the chamber that we serve in, and knowing that it's greater and it'll long outlast me. You know, I've been lucky to kind of go down this path, but I'm always open to something different that might take me a completely different direction. But at the end of the day, it's about just what you're giving. And as I said, it seems like in my life, the more that I give, the more that this world gives me back.
What has been one of the most defining themes that you feel like has gotten you to where you are right now?
I think that it's healthy and important to really take every moment for what it is and to take every day for what it is. Because if I look back, and I think about this, if I went back in time and could meet myself in high school, what would I say to myself? And I think there's a distinction between having a dream, between setting goals, and then taking steps. And they're all very important to have. Setting dreams and daydreaming is wildly important, and that's fun. It's a lot harder, though, to take those grueling steps to get where it is that you want to go. And then sometimes you're not sure where it is that you want to go. So it's finding purpose in every day, in every step that you're taking. I think becoming a parent and having kids has taught me that in spades. I think anyone who has kids will say, I get my parents now so much more, and why they were frustrated with me. But living in the moment, and I think that's the best thing that kids teach you, is they're not worried about yesterday. They're not worried about tomorrow. They're laughing and jumping on the trampoline right now. I've gone through those years too, where do you want to be the mom that says, no, I don't want to be in the water fight, or no, I don't want to jump on the trampoline. And just reminding myself, go play and have fun. And that's what we're here to do, is to make these memories and enjoy the little things and everything that's around us. So having a lot of faith that whatever path you're on, it's going to be okay. And like everyone else, I have days that are awful. And I always think that the cure for those days is a good night rest and a cup of coffee the next morning. I think it takes a little bit of time, though, to understand that and have that confidence that every day matters, and that even if that's not your day, tomorrow will be, and that it's okay to just kind of ease into this life a little bit and just be aware of what's around you and looking for opportunity. I think I've got a destiny to be one of those cool old Navajo grandmothers that makes amazing fry bread and gives the best hugs and is really warm and is kind of off the wall and tells inappropriate stories. I mean, so if I've got a dream, I think that's it. And so it seems like all these goofy things I'm doing in my life are just leading up to being that grandma on the rocking chair that can tell a good story and have some interesting things to share with my family. So I would say that at this point in my life, and I think that's kind of always been my calling, that's my dream, is I want to be that cool grandma.
It's a good dream. It's a real good dream.
To see Lindsay Linton's portraits of Nelchi and Affy Ellis, and to hear additional and extended interviews, visit her website, womeninwyoming.com. And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. Until next month, you can explore stories, photos, and videos at our new website, themodernwest.org. If you're listening online and want to take the show on the go, the Radio Public app works great on both Apple and Android devices. Lila Kineski produced this episode. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell. And I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.